This is Barry Tyker from the University of Wisconsin Oral History Project. Today is January 10th, 1990. I'm in the home of Mrs. Gertrude Wilson, 1825 Regent Street, right next to St. Andrew's Church. Mrs. Wilson has had an unbelievable amount of experiences here in Madison, has lived in Madison since you were how old?
Born.
Oh, you were born here. Okay, yeah. I thought you were
born
okay.
In that house.
So we're going to start out with her parents' arrival in Madison. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, father and mother were from New Hampshire. Mother came from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which, of course, you know, was historically very interesting. John Paul Jones' house. He never owned the house, but he lived there. Many historic and very beautiful houses in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. It also was the scene of the place where the Portsmouth Navy Yard existed and still does, I believe, although it's actually in Kittery, Maine. But it's always been called the Portsmouth Navy Yard, always. Portsmouth was the home and the site after the very earliest residence, and this is my ancestor's house, which is the oldest house standing in New England.
Oh my.
The Jackson House.
Built in 1664, the caption says.
Yes. The anyway, father and mother were from New Hampshire. Mother from Portsmouth, father from Tamworth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he graduated from Bowdoin. Oh, he went to Phillips Exeter Academy. And from there to Bowdoin College in Maine. Mm-hmm. He graduated, they were married in 1886. He taught 1 year in a boys' private school in Providence, Rhode Island, probably the Moses Brown School. Then, since English was his love and his field, and one could not get an advanced degree in English in this United States, they went to Germany. Germany was the seat of learning at that time, and they were there in Leipzig and Heidelberg for 3 years, from 1887 to 1890. While they were there, they became close friends of this university's later Dean Burge, E.A. Burge, the limnologist.
Right.
They were very close friends there in Leipzig. The Burges left because they had been in Leipzig prior to my parents' arrival there. So they left Leipzig before my mother and father did. And they came here. I don't know what brought them here, but they did anyway. My father, after his degree from Leipzig or there, they came to Madison after the 3 years in Germany, and studying in Germany. They came to Madison, and I think it was the Burges that really brought them here. They brought them to the attention of the university, of this university. The Burges at that time lived on Langdon Street in one of three residences, beginning with President Van Hise's house on the corner of North Park and Langdon Street, where the Union is now, Union Theater. That was President Van Hise's house. Next to that was the house which housed the University Student Clinic and infirmary. Wisconsin General Hospital hadn't been built. Next to that was the Burges house, Dean Burge.
And that was it on Langdon Street?
Those where the Memorial Union is now.
Right.
Those Memorial Union occupies the property on which those three houses were.
Was it called, what was the name of the street then?
Langdon.
It was Langdon.
Langdon
okay.
Street. And the, can't tell you what year the armory was built.
1893.
Well, anyway, so father came out and mother here in 1890. They lived first on Lake Street, right almost back-to-back to Professor Babcock. Babcock, you know, the milkman.
Yeah, right.
Milk. You know what I mean.
Yes. Stephen Babcock.
Yes, yeah, Stephen Babcock. And the Kesnicks also lived next to them. Kesnicks is an old Madison.
Wasn't there a store, Kesnicks?
Yes. Kesnicks had wonderful yard goods for sale. It was what we used to call a department store. They lived there from 1890 to 1895, when someone persuaded them to buy a lot up here in University Heights. So they built in University Heights, and the house and lot, where's the tin box?
Right down here. Oh, it's a cardboard box.
No, there's a tin box over there.
Okay.
A black tin box.
I see it.
You see it?
Yeah.
Now, in here, you will find, or I will, but my eyesight is so poor, the original business of the house. The price of the whole house and everything is in here.
Oh, my.
House and lot and windmill and well, all just short of
$6,000. Oh, my. A windmill, too?
Yes. Wait a minute here.
Were windmills common?
Oh, everybody had a windmill. The only people of the seven families who did not have a windmill was Richard T. Ely. He had a gasoline pump. We all had windmills. That isn't it, is it?
Register of Lease, 306 North Prospect.
No, that isn't it.
This is from 1947. Well, it's not necessary. As long as the price was $6,000. And it was called University Heights back then, too. Was it?
As far as I know,
okay.
University Heights.
Okay.
And the seven families were Mr. Buell, Charles E. Buell, the lawyer, Judge E. Ray Stevens, Richard T. Ely, the land economist, Professor Richard T. Ely, who came here from Johns Hopkins, Professor E.R. Maurer, M-A-U-R-E-R, in engineering.
Engineering, right.
Professor Hillier in chemistry, who later left because he got into a fight with Professor Leonard in chemistry. My father, Amos Arnold Knowlton, and Professor Charles Forster Smith.
And that was University Heights.
That was University Heights.
Back in 1895.
I was born in 1898.
1898.
But we built in 1895. The Buells built in 1894. They were the first. So, those seven families, I wrote, and I have another copy, which you may like to see someday, a history of life on the Heights around 1900. We used 20 tons of anthracite coal.
Oh my.
And we're never warm. Any more than I am here. This house was built in 1920 and has no insulation.
Yeah.
So that's why all these cardboards are up here.
Yeah.
Because the wind is so terrific.
Yeah.
And 20 tons of anthracite coal. We had four large bedrooms on the second floor. You go up the stairs, and then there's a landing, and then you go up some more stairs. And the attic, or the third floor, was perfectly wonderful. Huge room that Father used as his study, where there was a tank where the windmill pumped the water into the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tower room. Where's the picture here? What did we do with it?
I don't know. Is this
no,
not
no,
in this?
No, no, no. It was that.
Where did
on
we
that
put
chair.
It?
No. What did we do with
I
that?
I don't know. We moved it. There are some down here. Here. Here are some photographs here. Is that the book?
Well, that isn't what I was looking for, but it'll do.
Huh.
It's over here. That's better.
Okay.
Can you see up here that there's a...
Yeah.
The tower room was perfectly wonderful because it looked way out over Lake Mendota, and you see there was absolutely nothing in front except cornfields.
Yeah. I'm looking at a picture, and it's amazing because the house, there is one other house on the entire photograph in what is now University Heights that you can see on this photo.
Is it right here?
Yeah, that one.
That's Professor Smith.
And that's Professor Smith. Is he the law professor?
No. He was the classics.
Classics, okay.
Can you grab me that? Just pull a chair over. Because there's something.
I got that.
There's something I want you to see.
Cardboard falling out
here. Yeah, I want you to see this. This will probably show it better. That's the way the house looks now.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I know that house. I walk by
it
a lot.
Well, it's hideous now. They ruined it.
Yeah. This is on Kendall and Prospect.
Yes, but the house is spoiled. It wouldn't any more look like that than the man in the moon now. Anyway, you've seen that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what University Heights was.
When your father came to Madison, did he ever talk about what kind of a reputation the university had?
Oh, the university was perfectly wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. I think the heyday of the university, I would divide it this way. I would say from 1890 up to 1920. And I would say that we had some of the most marvelous people here. I heard over the radio this very fine program.
Here, I can put that in.
Well, it doesn't go in here. Or it did.
Yeah, it just sort of.
Maybe it was in.
No, it slides. It's just very, very narrow. That's all.
Every Sunday morning, CBS interviews different people.
Mm-hmm.
People of note.
Mm-hmm.
This last Sunday, there was a Robert Jastrow from Dartmouth College. It's the first time I've heard the name Jastrow since Professor Jastrow here. And I wondered if it could be his grandson.
Well, Jastrow is not a common name. I would not be surprised if he
was related. Because Professor Jastrow, oh, there were so many great people here then. When Father came in the English department was Professor Frankenberger, Professor Lathrop, Professor Cunliffe, Professor Beattie. Beattie was the man who taught about the English ballads. Professor Dodge, the man in Milton, was his field. Professor Frankenberger was closest to my father.
Now, what was your father brought in to teach?
English. English literature.
English literature.
And he... Well, he was way ahead of his time anyway. He was a pioneer in the first basin coming out here in 1890. Mm-hmm. My grandfather, mother's father, thought it was perfectly dreadful for her to come out here where there was nothing but Indians. And he was way ahead of his time in many ways. He wanted to teach English, the novel course. And that was frowned upon because it was not considered quite right to read a novel.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. To read a novel was frivolous.
So it was mainly essays and poetry?
Yeah. Yes. It was considered not really acceptable any more than divorce was acceptable.
So novels and divorce get on
equal. Well, I was a pioneer in the divorce field. I've been divorced since 1933, and I never remarried. And but he convinced them that it would be all right to teach the novel. When he came, there were people here like Professor Turner, Frederick Jackson Turner, in whose house I had my wedding breakfast in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He was here first, you know.
Right,
that.
And then went to Harvard.
And then went to Harvard, right. As Professor Hocking did. Professor Hocking preceded him, and that's really Professor Turner followed. Also, Professor Westerman was here, and he went, I believe, to Columbia. He was in history. Professor Monroe, great person in history. I don't know where Professor Monroe went. Carl Jung in English went to, I believe, Yale. Ralph Linton, and I think it was anthropology, went, I believe, to Yale. But he was a great deal later. He was not early. Mm-hmm.
Was it common for some of the better scholars from UW to migrate back to the East and go to Yale and Harvard and places like that?
No, it wasn't. Those I mentioned are probably it.
Exceptions, okay. Yes. So most people would stay here.
They stayed here, and it was it was enviable. Life was lovely. The university commencement exercises were held in Music Hall. There was a Maypole dance every May, which was perfectly beautiful on the upper campus there. Mm-hmm. The what is now, I believe, occupied by the School of Education was the College of Engineering building.
Yeah.
And of course, Science Hall is still there. Mm-hmm. That hasn't been destroyed.
Not since it was destroyed the first time and rebuilt.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think it's too bad that those three houses have disappeared.
Yeah.
Probably I'm the only one that knows of the President Van Hise's. He had daughters, Hilda and Janet. And Janet was a friend of my older sister's. You see, I was the youngest of five children. Mm-hmm. And naturally, I'm the only survivor at my...
What kind of children were Van Hise's children, daughters?
Well, Janet Van Hise was my sister Helen's friend. She later lived in Washington Square in New York. Mm. Quite a group of Madison people went to New York City, of Madison College people. Whitney Seymour, whose house was built by Balthazar Meyer, that great big white house with the steps up to it long
where
on
is it?
Arlington Place.
Okay, I think I know approximately. Yeah.
Janet, Hilda, the Van Hises were not awfully pleasant girls.
Hmm.
The Harriet Monroe, the Monroes were awfully nice. Oh, I didn't admit the Slaughters, too. They were just wonderful people here.
What about Mr. and Mrs. Van Hise? Tell me a little bit about them.
Oh, he was a wonderful man. In the first place, he was one of the best presidents we've ever had, in that he was not only good, had wonderful relations with the state in general and the legislature, but he was a scholar, a scientist, and an awfully nice man. And Mrs. Van Hise was awfully nice, too.
Did the president and his wife host a lot of social events for the university back then?
Well, you were always welcome there. It wasn't, you see, everything was so simple. It was simple and yet elegant.
Mm-hmm.
There was no such a thing as known as a cocktail party. People had lovely receptions. And there was conversation. Mm. Now there's TV.
You just made it disparaging for the record here. Rather disparaging.
Oh,
now.
Dear me. I didn't realize I was talking.
No,
about
I meant
that.
I meant your gesture. That's fine. Getting back to the Van Hises, your father, did the faculty find Van Hise?
Yes, the faculty knew the president, and the president knew the faculty, and there was a camaraderie such as never can exist now. It's too big.
Are there any particular aspects of Van Hise's presidency that stand out in your mind that your father related to you?
No, you see, father died in 1906.
Okay, I understand.
You see, he had cancer. Both my brothers died of cancer and both my sisters.
Mm-hmm.
I was the one that escaped.
So you were here when Van Hise died?
Oh, yes.
Too.
I was here.
What was that? What was that? How did that affect
the
campus?
Well, the Van Hises and the... I don't know when he died. Can you tell me?
1917 or 18, one of those two, I can't remember.
Yes, and he... when the First World War came, and he said goodbye to the troops on the lower campus, it was one of the most moving things I've ever remembered. Also, there was, a terrible epidemic of flu at that time, and... the university club was turned into a hospital, used as a hospital. the State Historical Society building has pictures in it. I don't know if they're still there, I don't know. One is of, I think, Reuben Gold Thwaites.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great friend of my family, he and Mrs. Thwaites. And Fred Thwaites, my brother Philip, here. Also, some of the great people were Professor King in Soils, who went to China. Now, that's unbelievable, you know, to go to China in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. And Paul S. Reinch, who was then called Minister to China.
Hmm.
That's what they used to call him, was here. Dean Russell, Babcock. Dean Russell lived in the house that was built for the dean of the College of Agriculture. And the Freds then lived there and wouldn't get out.
I heard about that.
Oh, dear me.
We all know that. That's the common fact.
Anyway, who lives there now?
It's a research station.
Well, that's where Dean Russell lived.
Yeah, that's the, and they're making a nice garden.
And of course, what we call the old dairy building.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they call it King Hall.
Hiram Smith Hall.
Yeah, Hiram Smith Hall is where we used to go and get our butter.
So those things were available through the university?
Oh, yes, we got all our milk and cream and butter. And I got eggs there from the time until they quit selling eggs. And I think it's a great pity they did. They used to sell them up to a couple of years ago. I've never bought anything but university butter. I still do.
Yeah. Did Van Hise have any particular friends on the staff, faculty, that he spent a lot of time?
Well, he and the Burges were very close. Professor Burge was a gruff person, but he was awfully nice. And Nan Burge was his daughter, and Ted Burge was a friend of my brother Philip. And Professor Burge always gave once a year the sermon at St. Andrew's Church on St. Paul's Day. And the last time he gave it, Nan was with him, of course, his daughter, when the UNO lived up here in the Heights later on. It was a mild day, and she said, "But Father, you've got your rubbers on. Take your rubbers off before you go up to the pulpit." "I'm not going to take my rubbers off. Somebody will steal them." So he stood and preached with his rubbers on.
Now, let's talk about church for a minute. What churches were there in Madison that most people went to?
Okay. There was Grace Church,
mm-hmm.
which was founded by Bishop Kemper,
mm-hmm.
whose great grandson I married and later was divorced from, my daughter. I said to Jill the other day, my daughter, I said, "Well, Jill, you've got the jeans, I've got the plate. I've got Bishop Kemper's plate," which is a perfectly beautiful plate, blue Canton, China. And then there was Grace Church. There was the First Congregational Church, which was downtown, a block from Grace Church.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't built, you know.
Mm-hmm. This, the one on University.
The one here is recent, right, as far as history is concerned. And it was designed by Hugh Greeley's brother from Lexington, Massachusetts, to look as closely as possible like a New England meeting house. Then the Unitarian Church was also downtown.
The one that's now the Frank Lloyd Wright one.
That was downtown where Manchester's parking lot used to be, but no longer is. There was the Christ Presbyterian Church was also downtown. It was a red brick building on the corner of Wisconsin Avenue and, I believe, Dayton Street. You see, that's Unitarian, Presbyterian, Congregational, Episcopal, and, of course, then there was the Roman Catholic Cathedral. Up right off the square. Isn't it still there or not?
Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah.
Used to be called St. Raphael's Cathedral, and the Dane County Courthouse used to be across the street.
Did most people in the university, was it pretty evenly divided as to where they went to church?
Well, when Father came out here, I believe it was President Van Hise said, you know, Professor Knowlton, good many of the faculty go to the Congregational Church. My father looked at him and said, don't tell me I'm expected to go to any one church.
And that settled that.
That settled that.
Where did he go, your father?
Practically not any.
No. That was my next question. Was it possible to come here and not go to church?
Yes. He didn't. He was not a church person. But he was a very close friend of Dr. Updike, who was the congregational minister and who had the service when my father died. Oh, another wonderful man in the faculty was Benny Snow in physics. Hmm. His famous lecture on snowflakes was one of the most famous lectures in the university.
Well, tell me about that lecture. I've never heard a thing about it.
Haven't you heard about it?
No.
His lecture on snowflakes was known all over the university and the state. And he gave it once a year.
It's one of those lectures that people would come just to hear the lecture?
Yes.
And it was Professor Snow who did
Snow.
It?
Snow, yes.
I guess that makes sense.
Yes.
When Van Hise was president, as you well know, the at least from a historian's standpoint, the Wisconsin idea, which wasn't called the Wisconsin idea at the time, was very popular, service to the state. Do you remember that as an emphasis at all?
Well, I remember this. In my very long life, I would say that the attitude of the faculty toward the university is different. When Father came out here, he and his colleagues were so proud to be here. They couldn't do enough for the university. But I think now the whole temper of the world has changed. It's what can be done for me, not what I can do for it.
So it's not service to the state now, it's service to the individual.
Well, that's not wholly the fault of the faculty.
I understand what you're saying. It's a generalization.
It's a general thing.
Observation.
It's a general observation I'm making. Yeah. It's shifted. And those, that wonderful spirit, I don't suppose exists. It can't.
You said earlier that you thought the heyday of the university, and I've heard several people say this who would know, you know, was from about 1890 to 1920.
I think it was.
What do you think accounted for the decline?
We had great scholars here. Great scholars and great fellowship.
Why did that change? Or what was responsible for
it? Well, you see, if you would say, maybe the First World War probably had something to do with it. There was a very serious situation in the First World War. There was a very strong feeling against the German department, and that was most unfortunate.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Professor Hohlfeld was in German department. Friedrich Bruns was. He was a friend of ours. And I think there was a petition. Now, I'm not entirely accurate on this. A petition to get rid of
Yes, there was. Well, there was a petition to get rid of LaFollette.
And I think that Burge signed that.
I think most members of the university did, as a matter of fact.
Yes. And we felt particularly keenly because we had living with us in this huge house after Father died on the third floor a young Professor Rittinghouse. He left after he came here as a graduate student from Germany. He left, went to Austin, Texas, and the feeling was so strongly against the Germans, he committed suicide.
Oh, my.
Oh, he was a lovely person. I have some lovely photographs.
What a sad thing. Now, Kaltenberg also had trouble, right? Professor Kaltenberg wasn't...
You mean Kallenberg?
Kallenberg, right.
He lived just this at the end of our block.
Weren't there some problems with him during World War One as well?
Probably. He was German. He was from Two Rivers.
What about Scott Goodnight and his teaching of German? Anything?
I don't know, but he was a bit... I don't like him.
Why not?
Wasn't he the man that the rocking chair...
Right, he's the rocking chair guy.
Fool.
I'm afraid he's going to have to live with that one for eternity.
After all, Professor Leonard was a great friend of ours. Yeah. William Ellery Leonard.
Well, we're going to get to Leonard in a little while because I am very interested in him myself.
Oh, he was a very close friend.
Getting
he
was back...
in love with my sister.
Oh, was he really? Getting back, that's what.
Go on.
Getting back to some of the divisiveness during World War II. So there were really two.
No, this was World War I.
World War I. I'm sorry. There were really two things going on, parallel things: the German Department episodes and the La Follette episodes.
Yes. The La Follettes were friends of ours.
Oh, tell me about that.
In fact, kind of Isabel La Follette, former Governor Philip La Follette's wife, belonged to a group that I've belonged to since 1932, what we call our Friday group, which met every 2 weeks. And Isabel La Follette and the Bill Case La Follette, the...
That, let me stop it here. Okay. We're side two now of tape one.
I was gone for 13 years.
Right. From
1919
to 1932.
I came back and was divorced and had to get a job.
Well,
my daughter.
Before we jump ahead to that, let's go back to the some of these things that were happening during World War One that may have caused a little bit of fracture in the university. Now, you knew the La Follettes. How did the family take this censuring of their of their father and their...
Not very well. The senior La Follette's son, who went to Washington, was a very fine person. Phil, who was the governor later on, I never was fond of Phil La Follette.
Mm-hmm.
I never cared much for him. And then, of course, there was Fola, the daughter, Fola La Follette, and... She married, a playwright by the name of Middleton. There was Fola, there was Bob, there was Philip, and there was Mary, another daughter. And they're all, the La Follette Cemetery lot is beautiful out here. But they, I think if it had been... I think it was, of course, hard on the family, the whole thing. But it was unfortunate because Wisconsin has always, over the years, it's had the reputation of being liberal.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean truly liberal. Mm-hmm. I don't mean pseudo-liberal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean the kind of liberal where a rich man will say that a rich self-styled liberal will say, "Oh, this black man should be this, but let him move next door," and he doesn't like it.
I understand.
There are plenty of those, too.
Do you think it's possible that what happened to Phil's father influenced his attitude toward the university over the years?
Yes, I do. But, there was Bronson La Follette, too. Mm-hmm. Of course, Bronson La Follette was the son, not of Phil, son of the senator in Washington.
Would you characterize the university before these two incidents as being, the faculty as being a rather united group or not?
Before the war, I would say yes.
It
became rather different after that.
Is it partly, do you think, because of these incidents that
yes,
occurred during the war?
Yes, I think the war had a lot to do with it.
And you don't, in your own mind, ever recall seeing that total cohesiveness return?
I don't think it's returned, no.
Yeah. Okay,
the climate is different. The world climate is different.
That's very interesting.
It's so different now. People, I was thinking prior to your coming, the three really significant changes over what I would say the past are. Husband and wife both working.
Mm-hmm.
Boys and girls living together unmarried.
Mm-hmm.
And the emergence of women in jobs. Those three are tremendously significant now. No decent girl, and I mean so acceptably mm-hmm. decent, would think of living with a man unmarried. Would have.
Would have back.
Nobody would have.
We're talking about the 19-teens when you were.
Oh, yes.
When you were
nobody young. Would. And of course, in Mother's time in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, if anything of that sort, if a girl became, an unmarried girl became pregnant, she threw herself into the river. Well, fortunately, we've advanced.
I don't think that's funny. It's just it's
no.
A,
I mean, we've advanced over
yeah.
that.
You mentioned a group that a name of a group that interests me. You talked about the Friday group.
Oh, the Friday.
Tell
lunch
me a little
group.
Bit about the Friday lunch group.
1932, when I came back to Madison to live, we organized a group. Rosamond Elliott Rice, Bill Rice, you know who he was. Rosamond Rice, Elizabeth Rauschenbusch, you know who she was?
Yeah, she was a...
Walter Rauschenbusch is in the faculty here. Rosamond Rice, Elizabeth Brandeis, Dorothy Walton, whose husband was in chemistry, professor of chemistry, Jane Goss, whose husband later left and
he
went,
came from the experiment
yes,
with the experiment.
Yes, he came from Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
Anna Ely, Richard T. Ely's daughter, mm-hmm. who lived just up the hill from us,
mm-hmm.
the same block. And I, and Isabella Follett decided we wanted to meet regularly. And we've met, of course, they're all dead but
mm-hmm.
me. Every, when we've added, and people have died, but it's still, we still meet.
It still goes on from 1931.
30,
and what you
we
have...
We met, we used to meet and have our, after the Union, Memorial Union was built, we had our lunch in the Beef Eater's room.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went back to the home of one of the members and played bridge.
Hmm.
Auction bridge then. Hmm. It's now contract.
I'm not a bridge player, so bridge players will appreciate that distinction, I'm sure.
And then we had cake at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But I was working. I was teaching in Madison Public School, so I could go only in summer,
mm-hmm.
summertime, and also in vacations. But... Then we quit going to the Union and decided that we would meet in private homes. Well, as life goes on, and we finally boiled it down to so that now we serve only coffee and dessert, and people bring their own sandwiches.
Mm. Okay. But it's still going to exist.
Well, the present members now, do you know who Paul McKendrick is?
Yes.
He's Dottie McKendrick. Hazel Rice, Bill Rice's second wife,
mm-hmm.
me, I don't know if you know who Professor McCamey, well, he was in political science and he's retired,
mm-hmm.
his wife, but she's non-compass, so she doesn't come anymore. That's four. Hazel Rice's niece has recently joined us, and that's Kathleen Haygood. Bill Haygood was in charge of getting out the publication for the State Historical Society, magazine. So, but that's it.
So you've been going 55 years now, something like that, 50, yes. 57 years.
Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult for me. I don't enjoy it as I did because my eyesight is so poor.
Now, this was started after you returned to Madison. Were there any groups that you belonged to or
oh,
knew of for women?
For instance, not for women.
Or for
But there was the Town and Gown Club.
Right.
Have you heard of that?
Yes, I've heard of that.
There was the Madison Literary Club, mm-hmm. which used to be literary.
Mm-hmm.
No longer is. It takes in Tom, Dick, and the Old Harry now. And, oh dear me.
Pretend you didn't
I
hear
hope
that.
You remember. No, but it certainly has changed character.
Now,
the Town and Gown Club was probably the most elegant.
In what sense? Just
in that it took the cream of the town people, like Professor Burr Jones or people like that,
mm-hmm.
and Rosenberry, Judge Rosenberry,
mm-hmm.
people like that, and the cream of the faculty. And they used to meet. It was a small club. And when they met next door, I was a child, nothing more really than a very young girl. They met at Professor Ogg's house,
mm-hmm.
who later, you see, occupied Professor Smith's house next door to us. And their ice cream was on the back porch. It was stolen. And I ate some of it. Well, the Town and Gown Club was really a very elegant club. I don't suppose it is going.
You know, I'm not even sure if it is. What about dining clubs? Were you?
No, there weren't such things as dining clubs.
What about women? Did they have their own organizations, bridge clubs or anything like that?
No, then nobody played bridge. Mother belonged to a sewing club on University Heights.
Now, you mentioned.
And women never called each other by their first names.
Oh, really?
It was always Mrs. Buell, Mrs. Ely, Mrs. Knowlton.
What about men? Was it different?
I don't know what the men... Well, Myron Stevens was brought up to call his father Ray, which was unheard of.
Now, you mentioned Judge Rosenberry. Now, he married a woman named Matthews, who
was Dean of Women.
Dean of Women. Can you tell me anything about her?
Yeah, she was a hellion.
Oh, was she really?
You bet.
In what way?
Well, the Rosenberries bought the house I was born in later on. And Dr. Greeley and the Rosenberries exchanged houses. And Mother was, by that time, in Portland, gone back east. And Mrs. Mother said, but I can't get the house ready as early as that. Mrs. Rosenberry said, Mrs. Knowlton, you will have the house ready by then. Judge Rosenberry was delightful. Mrs. Rosenberry was... probably okay, but she was not gentle.
A hellion, as you said.
She was not gentle.
Okay.
She was. We had a dean of women then, you know, and a dean
of
dean of men. And wasn't Dean Goodnight the dean of
men? Dean of Goodnight was the dean of men.
Dean Matthews, later on, with Judge Mrs. Rosenberry, of course.
Now, you said that. Let's go to President Burge now. He becomes president after President Van Hise's untimely death.
Yes.
And
Temporarily.
He was an acting president who ended up acting president for 8 years, longer than...
He was a great scholar in
limnology.
Limnology, and his place of work was Trout Lake.
Up in northern Wisconsin. Yes, I've been to Trout Lake.
Yeah. Lovely place.
Yeah,
perfectly
wonderful.
Lovely.
How did he come about? Why was he appointed president? Do you recall any discussion on that?
I don't, probably.
How was he received by other faculty members?
Oh, he was liked. He was very brilliant, very sharp, but he was sharp-tongued, and when our great friend, my family's great friend, Professor Giza in French,
mm-hmm.
gave a paper about Victor Hugo,
mm-hmm.
and... When the papers were given at the Literary Club, after the paper was given, there were two or three people to discuss it. Professor Burge got up and said, well, Professor Giza, you don't speak very highly of Victor Hugo, but you keep on giving the papers about him. Everybody liked. Dean Burge was liked.
Did he have sort of an ironic tongue? That's what
yes,
it sounds like.
Yes, but he was true. He was true.
So
I shouldn't say this, but I never cared for President Fred.
Mm. Well, we can get to Fred a little bit later on.
Well, I'll have to guard my time.
We'll turn off the tape recorder on that. So now Burge, tell me a little bit about his wife.
I can't tell you much about his wife. She died. I can't tell you anything about her because I associate Dean Burge with Nan, who stayed with him and took care of him and lived with him.
Is that Anna?
Nan. Yeah, I suppose it's Anna.
Yeah, that's how.
And the son and my brother Philip went down the Mississippi in a canoe.
Tell me about Nan.
Oh, she was a dutiful, loving daughter who took care of her father.
Now, when did
that was her life, to take care of her father.
When did the wife die? When's his birthday?
She died early, I can't tell you.
Before his presidency?
I think so.
So Nan was sort of served as the first lady, in a sense.
Yes, she was.
What did the faculty...
And then, they lived up here later on.
In University Heights, or...
up on Van Heights or Chadburn, I don't know which
in the president's house.
I think... No. They moved to a private house. I don't think they ever lived in the president's house. Nan lived until in a lovely house with a perfectly gorgeous garden on, it's either Chadburn or Van Hees, the same street where Dean Sellery lived. And Dean Sellery was not so kind.
Tell me a little bit about Dean Sellery.
Well, Dean Sellery and I swam across the lake from the Willows over to Picnic Point together. Dean Sellery was, he had it in for William Ellery Leonard. And I think he treated him very badly.
Why did he have it in for him? Yeah.
Because of Professor Leonard finally, Ellery finally went to Dean Sellery and said, "Why have you blocked my financial advancement?" And Dean Sellery looked him straight in the eye and said, "Because of your extramarital activities." Oh. And Ellery said to him, "But that's none of your business."
Good. What did Sellery respond to?
Well, I don't know what he responded, but he didn't take to that. Dean Sellery was he was very nice to my brother Philip, and my brother Philip was very, very advanced. He graduated when he was only 18. And Dean Sellery, and then he got it away. By the time he was 20, my brother Philip was in charge of the whole classics department at the summer school appointed by Dean Sellery. One summer school when the man they had called conked out at the last minute. And then my brother Philip went to Stanford University, the classics department there.
Now, as dean of LNS, Letters
of
Science,
he was okay.
How was he perceived by the professors from what you could hear?
I think all right. But he was not loved.
How would you describe his personality, essentially?
Sharp. Sharp and caustic. But he did appreciate scholarship. And he did appreciate, he knew that Ellery Leonard was tops.
Mm-hmm.
But he stood in judgment of him.
Was that, was it common for him to take sort of, to form an opinion like that and hold to it?
Oh, yes. He was stubborn, Dean Sellery was. And Professor Rowe lived right next door to him in the English department. Right up here,
Yeah. What about Mrs. Sellery? What was she like?
Well, Mrs. Sellery was overshadowed by the dean. No one ever, much of anybody ever mentioned Mrs. Sellery.
Oh, that's interesting.
But the dean.
Who did he associate with on campus? Do you know?
I don't know.
I'm going to skip a little bit ahead now and then come back to Burge. But, well, no, let's start out with Burge. How did Burge and Sellery get along?
I can't tell you that. I don't know.
What about...
I wouldn't think they'd get along very well.
Why?
Because I think that Dean Burge, and I always think of him as Dean, I think Dean Burge was a nicer person.
What about, now you weren't here, but maybe from what you've heard or from what you can speculate, how about George Sellery and Glenn Frank?
I can't tell you that.
Okay. Okay, let's get back to Dean. Now you have me calling him Dean Burge instead of President Burge. He assumed a caretaker role in the presidency, and you were still in Madison. and the feeling was pretty good on campus about his assuming the presidency.
Yes, mm-hmm. I think so. Burge Hall, of course, is named for him.
Burge Hall is named, right. And then you were gone, and he came, when you came back, he had been replaced by another, by a
Was it Fred
younger,
or was it Dykstra?
It was Frank, Glenn Frank.
Oh, Glenn Frank, yes. Glenn Frank was a disaster.
Tell me about Glenn Frank.
First place, he had this wife whom nobody liked, mm-hmm. and she called the university police to come shoot the birds that were waking her up in the morning, and that didn't endear her to the ornithologist in Madison. She was a misfit. I believe Glenn Frank was editor of the Century magazine.
Right.
Before he came here.
Right.
And he had ability, mm-hmm. but he wasn't liked.
He wasn't liked generally by
no,
the faculty?
No, he was not liked. He wasn't liked. He didn't fit in Madison. That's all. He should never have been here.
How much of a handicap do you think his wife was to the success here?
She was a great handicap. Great handicap. Because people in Friday lunch group couldn't stand her. And the recent people who we added to our group, like Rhoda Otto, mm-hmm. Max Otto's wife, and those people, politically were opposite, and they were very, politics has never been my great interest. Mm-hmm. My great interest through my whole life has been literature and reading, mm-hmm. and now I'm deprived of that, which is very hard for me.
Now, I've heard many people say that that Mary Frank was not very well liked. What was it about her that seemed
she
to rub people?
In the first place, she didn't have anything to do with the faculty wives. And her style of living was offensive. She took a walk every day accompanied by a university policeman. Well, you know, that was not necessary. And that didn't endear her.
Was she afraid people were going to rob him or throw tomatoes at her?
I don't know what she was afraid of. But anyway, he was a misfit. And then, of course, this terrible death.
Yeah, with his son, Glenn Jr.
Just dreadful.
You said the politics were opposite in the women's club and Mrs. Frank's.
Mary Frank. They were just, she was distinctly Republican. And that was not the climate of the university.
Had you heard anything about the political rival? I know you're not, you weren't much into politics, but did you hear anything about the political rivalry between Phil La Follette and Glenn Frank?
Well, if you stop to think, they would be on opposite sides of the pole, ends of the pole.
You don't, that seems to make sense. Do you know of any open hostility toward them?
No, I can't tell you that.
What, I want to talk about Glenn Frank for a while since we're on him. When he came here, he asked for and he got from the faculty permission to start the experimental college.
Oh, yes, that was marvelous. Friends of mine, John Goss, Paul Rauschenbusch, Ed Morehouse, of course, Micklejohn was the head of mm-hmm. it. Let's see. Who else came out?
Agard.
Oh, yes, Walter Agard. We always called him Ray Agard. Mm-hmm. Ray Agard. There may have been one or
two. Yeah. Well, we can look that up. Anyway. What was the perception of the experimental college from your point of view?
I think it was fine. Weren't they? I believe they were the forerunner of the ILS, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a pause there for several decades, and then ILS started.
Yes.
So generally, the people you associated with were pretty much in favor. Not only in favor, but several were involved in the experimental
Jane
college
Goss.
Itself.
Goss has kept five the most offensive Siamese cats I've ever seen in my life.
um, So from your point of view, at least, Glenn Frank's lack of popularity would not be directly traced to his involvement.
No, I think the political and everything. I think his coming out here was a mistake.
What about the match of Glenn Frank being president during the Depression? You talked about the rather high lifestyle of Mary Frank. Did that translate to the president as well?
Probably, yes.
Okay.
They just definitely didn't fit in here.
Okay. And you were here at the dismissal of the Franks.
Well, when?
1930, that was December 1936 that he was fired, and I believe Dykstra started in 37.
And then Dykstra. And Lillian Dykstra belonged to our Friday lunch group.
Yeah, we'll talk about Lillian in a minute because I've heard.
She was very nice.
Yeah, good comments about
very
her.
Very nice woman.
What about Frank's firing? How did that play in Madison?
Well, my friends were glad he was gone. But it's a strange thing, you see. Although my friends have been heavily loaded politically, mm-hmm. I never was.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, politics was not my main interest. I was, first place I was, they all had a lot of money and plenty of money and they didn't have jobs. And I had to get out and get a job and support my daughter. After my husband found someone he preferred, I was his first wife and he had three others in succession.
I see.
And he had only one daughter, who is my daughter, of course. And she lives at Monroe Street. Fortunately for me.
Did you know much about Max Mason?
Oh!
Max Mason.
Well, Max Mason is right in with the Ellery Leonard business, you know. Ellery Leonard. Max Mason was Max Mason. Yes, that was a. I can't tell you very much about it because I know that Max Mason and he was a great name here for a while, but I really am not clear enough about what role he played. I know that it was a...
You mean in the Ellery thing?
Oh, yes, Ellery Leonard.
What year are we talking about approximately?
Well, William Ellery Leonard moved after his first wife died. He also had studied in Germany.
Okay.
And he, after his first wife, committed suicide.
Approximately what year is this?
I'll tell you.
Okay.
He moved into the home... Professor Charles Forster Smith, who lived next door to us, I'm talking about up here,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
took him in to live with him. And this, my sister Helen was 15 years old. I was 13. So if I was 13 years old, it was 1911.
Okay.
Ellery Leonard moved in next door. So that was the year. And then Ellery Leonard fell head over heels in love with my sister Helen, and mother, of course, we didn't like that because he was 35 and Helen was 15. So mother sent Helen, I don't know where she ever got the money because we never had any, to Frank Lloyd Wright's school at Spring Green. Wonderful school there. You know about that school, don't you?
Was it called Taliesin?
No, it wasn't called Taliesin. Hillside School, run by his aunts, Frank Lloyd Wright's aunts. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Ellery Leonard was 1911 when he lived next door to us. But I kept our close friendship with him until he died. And I think the reason for that was that we were such good friends. There was never any emotional involvement.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have that kind of friendship if there is an emotional involvement. We had a very rare friendship. If he had any important subject that he wanted advice on, he always called me. And when he was going to, I said, "Now, Ellery, you know perfectly well that you're not going to get along with Grace Golden. You know perfectly well that you aren't going to get along with her." So he said, "I know I'm not going to, but I'm going to have her anyway." I said, all right then. Then when you get enough, when you get fed up, call me again.
Which he did.
Which he did.
So he was certainly a controversial figure in
Madison. Yes, I've got that chest over there, just full of stuff about him.
Oh, really?
And letters from him.
Oh, interesting.
To me.
What was his genius?
He was marvelous. The first place he was, on this, you see those stairs that go upstairs?
Right.
There are two books there. You know who Herbert Howe is?
Yep.
Well, Herbert Howe comes and reads to me occasionally. There are two books there.
Yeah, I see them.
Vault of Man?
Vaunt.
Vaunt, oh, I'm sorry. Yes, the N. And A Son of Earth.
Yes.
You called him Ellery.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Ellery. And he read to me from some of those the other day when he was here. Ellery, he was a splendid, he was a wonderful teacher, great scholar, and a real poet. Not the kind of stuff that's written now, which I don't call poetry, but it's not what I think of as poetry.
He was a great teacher. Tell me about his teaching.
He was a marvelous lecturer. He had very wonderful relationship with his students. And I would say that the only person who has equaled him in modern times and who is no longer here would be Denny Fisher. Mm-hmm. Denny Fisher, they didn't keep. They let him go because he didn't publish. There is such a thing as being a great teacher without being a great publisher. And I think the university makes a great mistake in demanding that everybody publish.
I'm going to stop right here because I have to put another tape on. This is Barry Tyker of the University of Wisconsin Oral History Project. It's still January 10th and 1990, and I'm in Mrs. Wilson's house. And while the tapes were being changed, we talked a little bit about William Ellery Leonard's background. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about his father?
His father was a Unitarian minister. He came from, I believe, Plainfield, New Jersey. I'm not positive about that, of the town. He had a sister. He studied in Germany during the time when Germany was at its heyday in scholarship, the place of learning to go to. Mm-hmm. I think he studied under a famous Egyptologist by the name of Ranke, I believe. Mm-hmm. He came here probably around, let's see, 1911, around 1908 or 10.
What did he teach when he came here? What were his court? What was his area of expertise?
Beowulf was Gilgamesh, especially Beowulf, mm-hmm. Anglo-Saxon, and he was a great teacher.
He didn't teach any poetry. There weren't such things as poetry courses.
No, he didn't teach poetry. He wrote poetry. He was a poet, real poet. He wrote some of the most beautiful things. Where are those books?
Right here.
Down there. Yes. And then I have his Beowulf upstairs. All my books are upstairs in my study. There are three bedrooms. I occupy one. I save the other for Jill and her husband when they have need to spend a night here, which isn't very often because fortunately I haven't had to have them, and the third I use as a study. You see, there's no place for books.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all upstairs.
You said that you got all your furniture from your grandfather, too.
Yes.
And it's quite exquisite. It really is.
From Portsmouth. Yeah, sure.
Now, what about, we've all heard our stories about William Ellery Leonard and some of his...
His first wife was the daughter of a professor on Langdon Street. And his long poem called Two Lives, have you ever read it?
Yeah, I've read little snippets of it.
Yes. Ellery always, t- told me that he did not know when he married her that insanity was in the family.
Hmm.
She did. It's one of the most beautiful epic poems I've ever read, Two Lives. The dedication is beautiful. Then,
and she committed suicide.
She committed suicide. They lived with her father on Langdon Street, right where the bend is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the bend, you know, the street.
Right, right. The bend, a few blocks from the Union. Huh?
Yes, on the north side
okay. Of
Langdon. And it was after her suicide that he came to live with next door to us.
Oh, okay.
Then he married a person whom he called Todd, Charlotte Charlton. And that wasn't very successful, as his subsequent marriages were not successful. Fortunately, he didn't marry my sister, because as fond as I am, or was, and always will be of his memory and of him, he would have been difficult to live with, especially later on when he contracted this psychosis of phobias, of not being able to go leave his apartment.
When did he develop that, and why?
Well, I was about probably, it was probably the result of his marriages, yeah. I was probably about 15 years old, and he and I were each on our bicycles. And we were on University Avenue where the railroad tracks are.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I can't cross the railroad tracks. You'll have to stay here with me. Something I'm afraid of. I said, I didn't call him Ellery, of course. I said, Professor Leonard, I can't stay here. I've got to go home. So you either come with me or you'll have to stay here. He did cross the tracks. That was the beginning.
That was the very first episode.
It was the beginning of it.
Huh.
Then his horizon became narrower and narrower. So finally his classes had to meet in his flat at 433 North Murray Street because he couldn't leave.
His phobia?
His phobia.
Was he couldn't leave the house at that point?
He couldn't leave the house. First he couldn't. His area of living became smaller and smaller and smaller. And then he published a book thinking it would help him, called The Locomotive God.
Right, I'm familiar with that.
Well, I'm not a psychoanalyst or any of that, but I don't know. I don't know what caused it, of course. It's most unfortunate.
Have you heard any friends or people, psychologists, psychiatrists, give explanations as to what it was?
No, we had a man here, Dr. Lorenz, who was in the early days of the medical school of psychoanalysis, who had a sanitarium, which is now the Oakwood Lutheran Center.
On Mineral Point.
Yes, and that's where, that was Dr. Lorenz's, originally, his private sanitarium for his patients, those little cottages. And I think that, I don't know whether Dr. Lorenz made any diagnosis of Ellery's problem or not. But to me, Ellery enriched my life over the years. I can't tell you how much.
So he was a good friend to you?
Oh, he was a wonderful friend. We had that, you see, that because there wasn't the emotional involvement,
mm-hmm.
and also we liked the same things. We liked the same things in literature. We liked, you know, we just...
What were his tastes in literature? What similarities did
he share? He was a classicist.
Was there a favorite work that he had or a favorite...
Well, he was...
Period?
Yes, I would say that wonderful period that I studied under Professor Lowes at Radcliffe, the English poetry of the 19th century, English poets. those were his favorites, I think.
So he eventually got to the point where he could not leave, literally
he could not leave. The classes met at his, he had the third floor, either the second or third floor, 433 North Murray.
I've heard tales also from people that he would sometimes get confused. This is before he got confined to his flat, and he would sometimes be found sort of like wandering around Madison, and everybody knew him and would just help assist him in getting back to his flat.
Well, fortunately, the University Club was right across the street.
Oh, okay.
So he could go there. So he anyway.
Did he then died in Madison, I assume?
Oh, I think so, yes. Yes.
And he taught right up to his retirement.
Well, he was, I don't know whether he taught right up to his, see, I was going through a lot of trouble myself.
Mm-hmm. With your own?
And mother was with me, lived with me until she was 92 years old. Mm-hmm. And my daughter, Jill had been very ill as a baby. She'd had one kidney removed when she was 8 years old, and then I let her go to San Antonio, Texas to visit her father. His wife's daughter had tuberculosis, and Jill got tuberculosis. So she was 25 months in a sanitarium across the lake here. In fact, I was going through so much trouble myself that maybe that was my trouble. My troubles, he was helpful to me, and I helped him. Mm. We were mutually.
But what friends are for.
Yes.
Now, we got off on, I'm glad we talked about William Ellery Leonard, but we had started out originally with Max Mason. I'd like to go back to
Max
question.
Max Mason was involved in some way with Ellery Leonard's first wife's family. But what it was, I can't tell you, because I'm not clear on it.
I have to ask you one little technical question. You said on the phone the other day that Kendall Street used to be named Adams.
It was Adams.
After President Adams.
It was Adams Avenue.
And then Chamberlain, which I live on, is, of course, after Thomas Crowder Chamberlain. And then Van Hise is after President Van Hise. The next street up is Mason Street.
I don't know anything about that, unless it could be Max Mason, but I don't think so.
Now, I had heard rumors, and maybe you can substantiate these or not, that Max Mason was disappointed that he did not become president when Glenn Frank became president.
I think he probably was.
And he subsequently went off to the University of Chicago.
Yes, I think so.
And I just wonder, I just thought maybe you knew if that was a double entendre or something.
I think that's true.
The street being named after Mason.
I don't think the street was named for him. I don't know why it was named Mason.
Okay, because it just seemed like such a coincidence.
It's right near there. It's right in that area.
Yeah.
Didn't Max Mason at one time, did he live in the house where Hugh Richards and Mildred live now on Arnold?
I don't know that much about. Now, most of the professors, while we're talking about it, most of them, there were only, when you first came, there were only a few houses on Langdon Street. So most of the professors were living where? Around Francis and Lake Street?
Yes.
In that area?
Yes,
this area was pretty much woods.
Oh, this was all open fields.
Open fields.
Open fields and wildflowers. It was just lovely.
Is this where you came for picnics on the weekend?
When we went out to Sunset Point.
And then the developments here started in the early 20s.
Yes.
And you witnessed that. So
this house was built in about 1920.
So you were gone from 1919 to 1932. So it must have really looked different when you came back.
Yes, oh, it was very different.
Because this house was built in what, 1920?
About 1920. This house is owned by the church.
Yeah.
The St. Andrew's Church owns this house.
And my house was built in 25, and I know most of these around
here
were built.
Now, who built your house?
I don't know the name of the builder. An early owner for many years was Barry.
Barry?
Barry. During most of the 20s, probably when you were gone. I know that, of course, because my first name is Barry. The rest of the owners, I really can't tell you. He owned it originally, I'm sorry, in 25 to about 30.
Well, now, how close are you to Highland Avenue?
A couple blocks, a few blocks.
Yeah. Professor Keenitz lived on Highland Avenue at one time.
So this was mainly university person.
It was, University Heights really was between Regent Street and University Avenue and Breeze Terrace and Allen Street.
Let's talk for we can't be for a minute. Oh, you want to bring something out there? Get down my thought here.
All right. We'll do these pictures.
Okay, we can do the pictures when we have the tape off
another
because they
time.
Really don't help. You can't really see them, obviously. let's talk for a minute about horses. Let's talk about transportation here in Madison. When
mother and father came out here, the streetcars were pulled by horses.
Were they called horse cars? Is that what?
Well, I've got a picture of one to show you
okay,
later.
Okay, we'll go look at that.
And they went only as far on University Avenue, only as far as Breeze Terrace.
Mm-hmm.
And the nearest telephone was at Schubert's Saloon.
Hmm.
And that was just beyond the tracks.
We,
none of us, had telephones.
Now, I've heard stories that Van Hise was quite a horseman, that he rode his horse
He had a horse, and so did Judge Stevens.
And was that a typical way of getting around?
To the people who could afford it. Most of us walked.
So horses were more or less a luxury.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Except for the horse cars, which were pulled the streetcars.
I've got to ask these questions because they're so fascinating. Where did you park your horse? Was there a kind of a little,
We had a barn. University Heights had a barn. On Kendall Avenue, let's see, we were in the 1700 block. 1800 block was the next one, 1811, where Professor Hiller lived. The 1900 block, there was the University Heights barn.
Hmm.
We kept our cows. We had a cow which we shared ownership with Judge Stevens. And horses. And the Mr. Rogers lived upstairs in the barn. And he took care of the animals, milked the cows, and brought the milk. This was before the university started selling milk.
Mm-hmm.
And took care of the horses. People had horses.
Now, when Van Hise would ride his horse to college,
I don't know where
Main
he
Hall.
Kept it.
Okay, that was my question.
Maybe he kept it in the hydraulics building.
when did horse cars go out of fashion? Do you remember?
Well, probably in the very early 1900s.
Okay. And they were,
when mother and father came here in 1890, they were pulled by horses. And I have a picture of one.
What were they replaced with then?
A trolley. There was a trolley that hitched up above.
Mm-hmm.
And when my brother Harry was riding in a streetcar pulled by horses, one of the horses fell down. And for months, mother couldn't get Harry to ride in a streetcar.
Hmm.
He was afraid.
That's interesting. That's such a great indicator of the change in times.
Yes.
Hussy
tumble down, hussy will, Harry would say. You couldn't get him into a streetcar.
That's really interesting. We're going to jump ahead now. Hold on one second. Okay, we're going to talk for just a minute about Clarence Dykstra and Mrs. Dykstra. Now, Dykstra, as you were just saying, was city manager in Cincinnati.
Yes.
And he was hired to replace Glenn Frank. Can you tell us a little bit about President Dykstra and his wife, Lillian?
Well, Lillian I knew because she belonged to our Friday lunch group. So I knew her very well, and I thought she was a very wholesome, nice person. She was friendly, the exact opposite of Mary Frank.
So she immediately made an impression.
She immediately made a place for herself.
Yeah.
And I think that he was okay, but he was not an outstanding president, either as a scholar but he was all right.
Do you remember when he was appointed president, what the what people were saying about that appointment?
They weren't crazy about it, but they were. He didn't offend people.
Do you know why he was appointed? Have any idea as to why he was appointed? Here we have another person coming from the outside, and someone who is not in scholarship.
Yes.
Following somebody the same.
Well, Glenn Frank was an able man.
Yeah.
he was no dummy. And I don't think that Clarence, that Dykstra was, had any great ability, either as a scholar or anything. But he was okay.
He was okay. What about, you mentioned the presidential house where he lived in.
John M. Olin left
the
house to be used as the president's house, and it was, as his residence. And it was used, at least through Lillian Dykstra's time. When it ceased being used, Dr. Laird lived there. Dr. Laird was in classics, and many, many years ago. You see, this is all interesting to me because I was interviewed by the by Herbert Howe for the centenary of the Madison branch of the American Archaeological Society recently. And Dr. Laird was, I haven't even mentioned various people that are down there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get
but
to some
anyway,
of that.
But anyway, I'm getting kind of tired.
Yeah, we're going to end in just a second. Tell us why, about President Dykstra. You said he didn't like the presidential house?
Mrs. Dykstra said it was an impossible house to entertain in. Have you ever been in it?
Yes, yeah.
Well, you go in this big foyer. And the dining room used to be, if it still is, I suppose it's been glassed in, looked out down the hill with the open lot. Is it still?
Yeah. And it's then, not an open lot now, but it's still. Behind, right. This,
yes.
It's an open lot, yeah.
But as you go in the house and turn to the left, you go down some steps.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was sort of what they call this stupid term now, they call it the family room.
So they weren't wild about the place
like
as
the
a layout
house.
For
no, she didn't.
For
after all, when the president entertains, it's his wife that is the hostess.
Yeah. Well, we're just we're getting toward the end of side three, and we've had a pretty long session here, so I'm going to end it today. Mrs. Wilson.
I hope I haven't done things I shouldn't.
Oh, no, you've been just wonderful. You gave me, you've presented me with a list of names and people, and we're going to get to them next time. And
I tell you, we've had some of the greatest people in university life.
Oh, I see
here
names.
In this university.
I see names here that weren't mentioned today that we will have fun talking with. Kiekhover is on here.
Yes.
Carl Jung is on here.
Carl Jung. Sonny Pyer.
Slichter we haven't even talked about. Van Vleck and Holfeld
is
mentioned.
Van Vleck and I were childhood friends, and Mrs. Van Vleck used to call my mother and say, "We will come and get Gertrude, and she'll come and have Sunday dinner with us and play train with Hasbrook. Nobody will."
Well, we'll start on some personalities next time. So, but for now, this is Barry Tyker of the UW History Project. We have just interviewed Mrs. Gertrude Wilson in her home on Regent Street. Stop.